Hello once again, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. Of course, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and here with me today, as always, my two nefarious compatriots, Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Good afternoon.
And Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. And we have a special guest with us here today. He writes as Mr. Beeks for Ain't It Cool News, and that is Jeremy Smith.
Good morning from the West Coast.
Man, it's like a time-traveling episode of The Film Stage Show.
Thrilling.
Breaking new ground. For anyone who's just joining us for the first time, first of all, welcome and where have you been? This is how we operate. We're going to have a movie topic discussion question type thing. Usually we try to tie it into news and current events, and today is no different. Today we will be talking about director's cuts, extended cuts, special editions. What makes the definitive version of a film that someone should see? And then after that, we're going to get into our feature review, which this week will be a discussion on the extended cut of Margaret by writer-director Kenneth Lonergan. Before we get into all that, though, I'd like to say for anyone who's commented and rated us on iTunes, thank you. You're fantastic, beautiful people, all of you. And if you haven't done that yet, you definitely should. You should also subscribe to us. And if you have any questions or comments on the podcast, you can get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So now that we've gotten through all that housekeeping, let us move on and go to our discussion topic for today. This is something that's been coming up a lot recently, especially with the advent of DVDs. The second those hit, it seemed like every movie was getting a special release.
This amazing new technology.
Like, it's like optical lasers burning stuff into a plastic disc. It's crazy. It's incredible. And because it's so easy to do, we're getting a lot of director's cuts and special extended editions. And on top of that, because we now have so much technology in movie theaters, we can do, you know, we're coming up on 48 frames per second, you know, 3D. So the question's becoming, what is the definitive version of a film? I mean, just this summer or earlier, we had Prometheus, and before it even hit theaters, there was news that there would be an extended version on Blu-ray. So we want to try to get a handle on what is the version of a movie you should see. If it comes out in 3D, is that the only true way to see it? If it comes out in 48 frames per second, does it really matter? Because you're going to technically be missing half the movie in a way that you won't ever realize. Guess first, Jeremy, why don't you tell us your thoughts on this plethora of different kinds of films that you can see that are all technically the same film?
Well, I tend to go with the director's vision, whatever he intended. If we're talking about a film that was shot in 3D, I'll go see it in 3D. If it was, you know, I guess, you know, 48 frames per second, like with The Hobbit coming up, I'll go watch that version of it, because that's how Peter Jackson intends for the viewer to see it. You know, in terms of like cuts and, you know, all the different kinds of cuts that are out there, I mean, it's so hard because, you know, you have certain directors who just, they keep tinkering. They keep going back. They keep, you know, wanting to change things. And so, you know, what might be called a director's cut, it's the director's cut for that day. You know, it's like, I think with Ridley, you know, Ridley Scott's notorious for always, you know, kind of futzing around with his movies. Michael Mann does the same thing. And I think that both directors have, on some of their films, they've drastically hurt them. And other ones, there are some great director's cuts out there as well. But oftentimes, director's cuts feel, you know, it feels like it's, you know, you're always like, okay, I'm glad that I saw that, but I know why I left it out. And yeah, so it just comes down to the if it is the director's vision, if it's his true vision, and it's not just him goofing around, then you know, that's the version I want to see.
I'd say that I align pretty well with that, but some people might have a different opinion. Nick, what about you?
I'm not one of the people that have a different opinion. I think our guest is spot on. I generally, when I hear that there's a director's cut of a film, I'll do a little bit of research before I actually choose one. I'll read multiple reviews of both versions, and I'll look at comparisons. There are actually a few websites that are very good at doing that. They'll do shot-by-shot comparisons of where scenes have been altered and whatnot. And that's usually how I decide, unless, of course, there is this overwhelming consensus that the director's cut is better. Look at Kingdom of Heaven, for instance. Mm-hmm. I never once had an interest in going toward the theatrical cut a few years ago when I finally got around to it. But at the same time, am I sticking to Ridley Scott? Am I really going to watch the version of Gladiator that's 20 minutes longer? I don't know. I do think that I align with the director's. I side myself with the director every time, but there are instances where, of course, they do not know when to stop, and they're sort of their own worst enemy in the editing room. Unfortunately, it's I don't know if it's a question that really has a correct answer. There are so many instances, and you can go so many ways with director's cuts.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, we keep bringing up Ridley Scott. I mean, how many versions are there of Blade Runner right now?
Five.
Yeah, and you can buy them all on Blu-ray. It's and I don't understand the point of that. You know, I feel like if you've created what you think is your definitive vision, it's kind of weird to let the other ones continue running around. Of course, then you run the risk of becoming like George Lucas, who's kind of reviled for not releasing the original Star Wars trilogy the way that it came out in theaters. As for my own personal tastes, it really, really does come down to a lot of different questions for me. I mean, we've already talked about directors who can't stop tinkering. I think that's the best possible way to put it. You know, a lot of authors will tell you that when they've written and they go back and edit and then edit, they have to sooner or later stop themselves. Because as you've grown through the editing process, you realize there are more things you want to change. And therefore, your work could technically never be done. And I think that there's just a kind of letting go that some people can't get a hold of. Personally, I usually tend towards the extended edition. I have the extended edition of many, many movies. Some of them, like The New World by director Terrence Malick. I mean, the extra material is great, but I don't know that it's completely necessary to the story. And using the term extended edition is even more, I guess, water muddying, because it's still not saying director's cut, because when you say director's cut, you're putting your name on it. You're saying, like, yes, this is what I wanted to do, which is something that I hear that Lonergan did when doing the Margaret extended cut. It was, like, specifically an extended cut and not a director's cut. Mm-hmm. So things like that make me wonder if, you know, some years down the line, if this movie grows enough in esteem, if we're going to get that. But that's trending a little too close to our review, so let's turn it over to Danny for his take on this.
Well, I was actually very eager to get into Margaret, but I will pull back for a second.
Apply the brakes.
Yeah. I guess if you're talking simply director's cut versus theatrical cut, it's hard to kind of argue that the director's cut isn't worth seeing, even if it's not as good or even if there's stuff that obviously shouldn't have been in there. It's still kind of a good way to just get information about the director and maybe what he wasn't able to do the first time. And what kind of interested him that he couldn't put on the screen. But once you get into more editions of a movie with an extended cut, or if it's in theaters when you have 3D or not 3D or IMAX or regular or 48 FPS or 24 FPS, it kind of, the problem for me becomes when I want to talk to someone about the movie and we've seen it in different versions, then how is that conversation going to go? Because if they come at me and say, well, you know, I really love the movie and you clearly didn't, so you should probably see it in my version. It's kind of like this weird tension. You know, the way things are going right now, it feels like that's only going to escalate. It's almost like every year is bringing us a new way to see a movie. And that's kind of like a kind of unsettling thing that's happening in some ways.
Yeah, it's kind of like people who say, you know, you haven't really listened to Miles Davis unless you've heard him on vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, personally, I would think that you really haven't heard him unless you were there in person. But that's just me. I wanted to ask one question before we left this topic behind. You know, like I said, I say this constantly because I'm worried that people assume that we're here to make a final judgment, and we're not. It's just nice to get opinions about things like this, especially considering the overwhelming multiplicity of different ways to watch something. Is there a specific version of a movie that you think was either overwhelmingly helped or overwhelmingly hindered by a director's or extended cut?
Well, you brought up Kingdom of Heaven. That's, you know, that's a radically different film as the director's cut. It's the studio cut of it was completely, it was just an abomination. I mean, it didn't even hold together as a narrative. Mm-hmm. That was a complete mess. And, you know, it really, yeah, we finally got Scott's vision, like, you know, a year later. Then, as far as, like, a director who's hurt his movies. I mean, you know, Michael Mann, I would say, boy, I could pick a movie. I mean, his Last of the Mohicans director's cut, it really kind of hurts the film. He just made needless alterations. And Miami Vice, I don't know if you guys are fans of that movie or not. I was a really big fan of the theatrical cut. Now he's added, he's added in this boat race and everything.
Oh, yes. Beginning,
and it's just like, it's just extraneous. Has no reason to be there except for they shot it and they want it in the movie. And so, yeah, those would be two examples.
Yeah, Michael Mann, I think, I would argue he has a worse director's cut problem than Ridley Scott, honestly. Because why do there need to be three versions of Heat that are slightly altered from theatrical release to DVD to Blu-ray? Do you know what I'm speaking of? On the Blu-ray of Heat, he decided to change things again just a little bit by, like, removing one shot here or adding another shot here. He's a guy who can't really make up his mind, which is weird because I feel like his first instincts are usually so good, and then he's just going back, and I'm thinking, what are you doing, man? You got it the first time. Speaking of getting it the first time, I think in terms of being hindered by a director's cut, my biggest example is Apocalypse Now Redux, which I like that film because one of the best films of all time is contained within it. But then you have, of course, is the French plantation scene, which is often chastised, even though I kind of like it, but it feels extraneous. And then you have the Playboy Bunny scene, which I'm sure if you guys have seen Redux, I'm sure you remember it.
Oh yeah,
because it doesn't end. that's, or you have the added bit where Kilgore flies over the boat and he's looking for his surfboard. It's those little things that completely break up the rhythm of Apocalypse Now, because to me that's always been more of a mood piece than anything else. And he kind of, Coppola's intentions with that cut are very interesting. He kind of wanted to chart the history of Vietnam backwards by, you start out at the war, then you go back to the French, and then you get to this sort of nomadic civilization, which is an interesting attempt. But when you see it, it kind of breaks my heart because I think, wow, maybe he didn't really have it that time. He almost got lucky that Apocalypse Now came out that way.
Yeah, that's a problem that a lot of these have, actually. They really tend to shake your faith in someone that you thought was a really spectacular artist.
I mean, I still think Coppola is, don't get me wrong, and Apocalypse Now is one of my absolute favorite films of all time, but am I ever going to watch Redux again? I don't know.
Yeah, I will not. It was an interesting experiment, I think, just to put it back out there in theaters, but it does not hold together.
And that's actually an interesting case because they have a little icon that appears that shows you what wasn't in the original film if you play it with that that function on.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I would say, Redux, I kind of like it, and I mainly for the same reasons that you do, Nick. I can appreciate what he was trying to do. But those added scenes really do kind of grind the film to a dead halt. Mm-hmm. It's weird. And I'm wondering if that had been the original release, if it still would feel that way. Like, if we just know that since those weren't in there originally, they stick out a little bit more.
It's always a very weird feeling when you watch, because I didn't see Redux for the first time until a couple years ago, but I know Apocalypse Now so well, so it's really strange when you watch a movie you know well, and then these new scenes just start playing.
Yeah, it's like, where did this come from?
I saw a quote-unquote extended cut of Pulp Fiction on Bravo, where they called it that, but they just put the deleted scenes in. And suddenly, you have the great character actor, whose name I can't remember, unfortunately, who plays Monster Joe, Monster Joe's Truck and Tow. Or is that
Dick Miller.
Dick Miller, that's right. Yeah. It's even when I watched Margaret, it felt kind of strange how, suddenly she's at her school play doing the rehearsal. And we'll get to that in a minute. Or Lord of the Rings, for example. When you watch Fellowship of the Ring and there's that longer opening with Bilbo writing his The Hobbit. I mean, I love that stuff, but it's a little jarring.
And Danny, close us out here. What do you think are some movies that were hindered or really helped by the cut?
Well, I'd say Blade Runner was really helped. I actually saw that they had a thing at Lincoln Center in New York before Prometheus where they were showing Ridley Scott movies, and I saw the final cut there, and that was great. And I think that's one case kind of like Kingdom of Heaven where most people agree that his final cut was significant improvement over the theatrical. And in terms of Redux, I actually saw Redux first before I saw the original, which is strange because I was watching it and it was it was dragging like mud. I went back and I finally watched the original, and it's, you know, it's obviously a lot better. But yeah, it does have some problems pacing wise.
So I guess that answers my question about if you saw Redux first. All right, well, excellent. I think that, you know, this being said, and this gives us a good context in which to enter our discussion about Margaret. Like I said, directed and written by Kenneth Lonergan, and starring a lot of people. Anna Paquin, Mark Ruffalo, Jean Reno, J. Smith Cameron, Kieran Culkin, Matt Damon, T. Broderick. I probably missed a lot of people, but you know what? There's just too many to name.
Olivia Thirlby sits in the background for a bit.
Yeah, I kept expecting her to say something, and she never did. But yes, so let's talk about Margaret. Margaret is a difficult film to slap a synopsis on. Before I went to watch it, you know, I had to warn everyone in the house that I would be gone for 3 hours. And I told them, you know, it's about a young woman in New York who witnesses a bus accident and the way that it kind of affects her, which is technically correct, but really, really underselling this film. I can't even really begin to explain the thematic depth of this movie. So I'm going to pass the buck. Jeremy, since you're our guest, and I know you have a bit of a history with this film, why don't you start us off on our discussion? Why don't you tell us, you know, how you came to this film and what you thought of it?
Well, I first wrote about this movie in 2004 when it was just a screenplay that was, you know, I'd heard so many great things about it. And I think it was Scott Rudin said it was the best piece of material he'd ever had. And it was by Kenneth Lonergan. And I was a fan of his from You Can Count on Me and also This Is Our Youth, the play he wrote. So I read the screenplay and was just floored, like finished it, picked it right back up, read it again. And I couldn't believe everything he was tackling in the screenplay and that the movie was even getting made. And I fell in love with it. And so, you know, a year later, you know, they shoot the film and another year goes by and another year goes by. And you're like, what happened to this movie? And it was funny, you know, I would ask around and, you know, you'd never really get a straight answer. And then finally it ends up, you know, being a legal dispute and whatnot. So, you know, finally when this movie comes out, you know, and I've read the screenplay at this point, probably, I don't know, you know, maybe even 10 times. And so it's like, okay, here, this is the actual movie. And that first viewing was just disorienting. I scenes played differently than I expected them to. A lot of scenes were missing. This is the theatrical cut. And it just, I couldn't make sense of it. Even though I'd read the screenplay so many times, I couldn't make sense of this version of it and how it was impacting me, because my take on the material was much different than it was back when I read it as a screenplay. It was, you know, I thought it was a little more sprawling as a screenplay, and as the theatrical cut kind of does almost zero in on Lisa. Like it's her movie for the most part, I would say. And that's the Anna Paquin character. And so, yeah, it took me three viewings to actually kind of get my bearings with the movie. And then I decided that I loved it, you know, even though it was a bit rushed at the end. And you could see where they were just, you know, kind of trying to hit that 2.5 hour mark, because he had a final cut up until 2.5 hours. Yeah. And so it was just really such a sprawling film. You just don't see movies like this. They just don't get made. It seems almost like an accident, but I'm so grateful it exists. And it's a movie I now that I have it on Blu-ray, I keep going back to it and watching it.
Danny, what about yourself?
Well, I saw this with Nick, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
And I basically saw it because a few critics I really liked had it in like their top tens at the end of the year, and I wanted to see it because, you know, I wanted to see as much as possible before I write my own. I really liked it, but it's almost like I was going in wanting to confirm that it was like a top 10 movie in a weird way. So watching this extended cut the other day was kind of a great experience, because I just kind of let the movie happen to me, and I was able to take everything in. And it was nice because I was catching up with the theatrical cut because I'd only seen it once, while at the same time I was getting these new scenes and kind of seeing how they were playing. I think it's a great movie. And one of the things I like about the extended cut is that it feels more sprawling, like you mentioned, that the theatrical cut maybe doesn't, because in the extended cut you get a lot of kind of moments where the camera will just follow a plane or a helicopter or a bird, and it'll interrupt conversations and it'll just follow that object in the sky for like a minute. With moments like that, you really get even more of a sense of how much kind of ambition and hunger was behind this vision. Once you kind of add that all together, it's really just an overwhelming kind of experience that you just can't get anywhere else.
Wow, that was damn good. Nick, what about yourself? How are your thoughts on this?
Danny raises a salient point.
Reference to all right, the film. Reference.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so yes, I've seen this movie 3 times now. I was actually one of the 6 people who saw it on its opening weekend, believe it or not, in a surprisingly crowded theater. I don't know. It seems like a lot of people maybe just showed up there by accident, because I don't know how else they would have heard about it, because Fox Searchlight didn't advertise this movie. And I liked it at the time, but I did walk out and I kind of said to the people I was with that it didn't feel like I had watched a movie. It kind of felt like I watched a book being acted out, but in the sense that they opened a book and they just sort of filmed that. And then I saw it again in December, and this is after I had read the full screenplay. And I still kind of felt the same way, but it started to smooth over for me some of the rougher patches. And then I watched the extended cut, don't call it a director's cut, on when did I watch that? Wednesday. And I think I finally made a more conclusive decision on the film, and I like it quite a bit. I'm not as head over heels as some other people, because I do prefer the more lyrical first half to what feels like a slightly more plot-driven second half. It almost makes me think of have you guys ever seen The Passenger by Antonioni? For some reason, this movie almost reminds me of that, and I know that's a weird point of comparison, but more in the sense that you're watching the first half of either film, and you're kind of, or at least I'm thinking to myself, this is a total masterpiece, and who knows, if it keeps going this way, it'll be one of the best films I've ever seen. And then the second half comes, and it's still quite good, often great, but you have to sort of adjust to it, because I find that Lonergan does sort of zero in on Lisa a little bit more when you get to the 90-minute mark or so, because that's when the more traditional plot starts to kick in. But in this extended form, I still find that it still feels more concrete, but also free form. And I remember someone said this movie is kind of like jazz. It's dramatic jazz, which is, I think, a good reference point. There's still so much more to say. I'm just trying to get some basic thoughts out there, because it, you know, how do you try to sum this up in 3 minutes? So I'll just stop speaking now. And
I'll, I will fill the void where you used to be. I had heard a lot about this film. I did my best not to read any actual reviews, but I did read, I think it was New York Times Magazine piece about the wrangling to get it made and then to get it shown. So I was really interested to see it. And I made the conscious decision, knowing that we were going to be talking about it, not to watch the theatrical cut. Because as we were talking about earlier, sometimes you can just really tell where the new scenes have been inserted. And I wanted to see if I could get a feel for that, and I couldn't. This movie is 3 hours and 6 minutes long in its extended form, and if I had to make cuts, I honestly don't know where I would begin. And I think that's one of the reasons that there was such a problem getting it out. I don't think I've ever been quite as taken with a movie's use of sound editing and sound design. There are scenes in this film where the main characters will be in the background talking. I'm thinking specifically about a scene in a diner or a cafe.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't hear what they're saying because there's another conversation going on in the foreground, and the movie is focusing on that conversation. So you can tell something very important to Lisa, Anna Paquin's character, is happening, but you're not getting that. And there are scenes like that everywhere where, you know, there'll be an establishing shot and you can hear the snippet of someone like trying to get their friend, brother, father, maybe even out of like jail, you know, saying that they're going to post bail. and just things like that, and like characters talking on the phone, and you can hear a conversation going on in the background. Insofar as it ties into the theme of the film, I thought that was a really interesting creative choice that I don't know that I've ever really seen most other places. I think that adds to that sense of jazz that you were talking about.
Well, I mean, it's kind of Altman-esque. I mean, you know, with just the overlapping dialogue, but I mean, you really can't, as you were saying in that diner scene, quite make out one conversation. It just, mm-hmm. Watching that extent in the extended cut for it, because that was a scene that was not in the theatrical.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus. I feel like I'm going to have that reaction a lot, so please bear with me.
Yeah. No, that wasn't in there. And, so watching it, I was kind of like, you know, first, because I knew that scene existed. I'd heard so much about it. But, you know, watching it play out again, it's one of those things where I was like, the first time through, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Not sure that works. And then, like, I watched the movie again and I was like, oh, God, this is a wonderful scene. And that seems to be like my experience with the movie. Is like, it's always the first time through, I'm like, okay, that really hit me, but I don't know if it works. And then watch it again, it's like, oh yeah, of course it works.
So. Yeah, I guess I'm lucky in that regard, because I think everything clicked with me pretty much immediately. Though there was a scene, I can't even remember where it is in the scope of the movie. Lisa's mother has started dating Ramon, who's played by Jean Reno, and she's in a play, and they have their first show, and then a review comes out that's really quite glowing. And then she's saying that after that review, the audience has begun to react differently. Like, they're standing up and cheering, whereas the first time they were just clapping.
It's like she's Michael Richards in Seinfeld.
Exactly. And
the first time I saw this movie, I thought, oh, it's just like season 4 of Seinfeld, where they had to tell the audience to stop clapping for Kramer. That's a complete digression. Go on.
That's fine. But no, it really is. Like, and I kind of almost at some point felt like the director was speaking directly to me. Like, you know, I've obviously heard that this movie was good, and I was concerned about like that influencing me. Like, you know, that's kind of, oh, everyone else likes this, I better like it too. And so when I began to like it so heavily, so immediately, I was like, oh God, they've gotten to me and I'm going to be completely blind to this. And then that scene comes up and it was like a small moment of persecution. But oddly enough, that actually further cemented my admiration for the film because of that, because of the fact that this is a person who obviously has a lot of ideas regarding storytelling and reaction and just the way that we view the world. And yeah, I mean, I never would have thought that I'd see a 3-hour movie and then immediately want to watch it again. But I did, but yeah. I wanted to watch it with someone else, and no one was willing to do that at 11 o'clock at night. So I got to wrangle them in earlier.
I think that's telling, though, because both times when I saw the theatrical cut, when it ended, I was kind of ready for it to be over. And I didn't have much desire to go back at the moment. Maybe a few weeks later, I'd think, I'd like to see that again. That's exactly what I said, too. Really. But yeah, when I watched the extended cut, as soon as it ended, I thought I would kind of like to watch that again right now, because I think it's a much richer, much more layered, and much more affecting movie overall.
Yeah, it might be to my detriment that I haven't seen the theatrical cut, but I mean, I almost don't want to now. Like, I don't want to know what was done to this film that I now have such a deep admiration for. I think, Jeremy, you said this doesn't feel like a film that you see getting made. Recently, definitely, and maybe ever. I mean, the sheer like number of concepts that are in this film, and also just the accuracy of the vision. I mean, I was on, this is a personal thing, but I was on tech crew in high school, and those stupid powwows between like all the actors where like all their personal drama would get dragged up and they'd all cry and talk about how great the thing is going to be. Like, I was the Kieran Culkin character. I was Paul. Just like, I just want to do my job and then go home. Like, I don't want to be out here with all you people, like, giving your feelings away. And things like that, again, you don't really see them played that straight, but also with that amount of knowledge.
You know where else you don't see it? In the theatrical cut.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I remember when...
How that is that scene, not in the theatrical
cut? I remember when that scene came up, because I remembered it from the screenplay, and I really loved that scene. And I just... When it started playing the extended cut, I was like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding. This is here.
I can't believe that they cut that out.
Yeah.
That was such a good scene.
It is.
No, and you're right. It is incredibly accurate. I mean, I got my degree in theater, and yeah, I've been a part of and have been on the outside of many of those powwows.
Oh my god, I can't, like, I'm like my mind is literally stopped at the idea of those two specific scenes that I loved so much not being in the theatrical cut, that I'm actually starting to get a little angry.
Because someone decided at some point that they didn't serve a narrative purpose. So, you know, it's like, those are exactly the kinds of scenes that, you know, no one even thinks to write because, you know, it's going to be cut out. You know, we don't have a lot of, I don't think people really like mess. You know, they like, everything has got to be so structured now. You know, we've really, the whole hero's journey thing has, it's really taken over in every genre, not just, you know, not just adventure films and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's a good point. I mean, this film, I feel like it one of the reasons that it does what it does so well is because it does thrive on giving us those asides and giving us the deeper picture of who these people are mm-hmm. and what they're doing. And I can't imagine seeing this film without those scenes. They're so elemental to it. I mean, there's a lot of scenes of just people in class talking about things and mm-hmm. you know, the more that Lisa kind of self-persecutes but also self-denies her involvement in this bus accident, you can kind of tell the more she's just lashing out during these discussions. Please don't tell me this was cut. There's another scene where she's arguing with one of her classmates who I think is Syrian.
Oh no, that's in there.
Oh, thank God. And I mean, they get into it earlier in the film and then they get into it again, and I don't know, just like the escalations that you see here. I mean, you know, they're not the type of things where it's like the dinner scene with her mother, where her mother starts throwing things around. I mean, that's kind of like plot important, but those scenes in the classroom are like character important.
Mm-hmm.
And
also, oh no, please.
I was just going to say, that I was just going to wrap up my thought. So go ahead.
Oh, this could dovetail into another aspect of the conversation, but it's shocking how it's shocking how accurate that is to what a classroom discussion is like in the worst way possible. You have two people who are arguing a point, and I guess I'm sort of like the Olivia Thirlby character where I'm just kind of sitting in the back thinking, shut up, stop. or sometimes I'll be the boy whose name I can't remember, who's just kind of throwing in stupid comments, but as I am right now, actually. But anyway.
That's what we have you here for.
Yes, thank you. But that speaks so much to the film's accuracy, those scenes where it feels like, I don't know, I mean, you've heard stories about how the Lonergan kind of took his own classroom experiences and put them in the scripts, but it would almost feel as though he spoke to a teenager when he was writing it, because it feels so current and so true to life. But then that would be enough for me, but then the way he extends that into the entire movie, the way that people are talking on the street, or the manner in which she's speaking with her mother, it's just kind of one of the, it's like what Jeremy said, people don't like mess in movies, but I would so take that over another hero's journey, because it speaks to me. And there were so few movies last year that really kind of nailed things down this perfectly in terms of human interaction. Although technically, I guess, you know, we're talking about a movie that came out this year, sort of.
Yeah, I was going to say, this movie came out, you know, this year / last year, but also it was made years before.
In 2005, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the weirdest thing. Really shocking to see Anna Paquin doing actual acting, especially after, what is it, 4 years of True Blood?
Mm.
That was a little shocking to me. Also, Matt Damon, surprisingly young. It really is weird, because you get this idea, you know, I obviously had never seen this before, and most of the talk about it came up last fall and winter, and so to see these people so young was just kind of jarring, because it felt like this was a movie that had been out for a while, and, you know, was probably, it had that sense of importance to it that you get, like, when you first watch Lawrence of Arabia. You know, the type of thing where it's like, this is a movie that's so good that I can totally tell why people continue to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only been around for a couple months. It's really, really strange to me. Yeah, I was going to say, does anyone have kind of an opinion on, if you had to nail down the overarching theme, or, I don't want to use the term moral, but the through line of this film, in a dramatic sense, like, what do you think it would be? Because a lot of people have said something about this being like the first really great post 9/11 film. Do you think that's reductive, or is that fair, or is it even grander than that?
I mean, it's definitely a play. It's it depends. I mean, like we've kind of said, this movie hits you in so many different ways, and every time I see it, I kind of have a new take on it. I think that there is this kind of cathartic thing that it's like a really big catharsis, and I think it's kind of a catharsis for New York, for, kind of 9/11, and it's, and I'm trying to think of a way I can, articulate this, but it does, and of course ending at the opera as it does and all that. I think that that's kind of, it's trying to evoke this emotional kind of, not a letting go, but kind of a getting over it, the storm mm-hmm. passes. In fact, he writes that in the screenplay, the storm has passed. And I think that's kind of like the overarching thing I get from it.
It's interesting if you look at the movie from that perspective. I think in that sense, it actually becomes a very angry film, if you think of it that way. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that idea.
If you could expand on that a little bit, I think I might.
Well, I think that if you look at it as sort of a getting over of the events of 9/11, which I don't want to pigeonhole it just specifically to that, but that is a good idea. I do think that it sort of feels like Lonergan is kind of screaming, saying that people handled this situation entirely wrong. They sort of acted like a teenage girl, if you will. And there's something that's really bold about that I happen to agree with that wholeheartedly, but it's not something that you can really... It's good that he made that subtextual is what I'm trying to say, because you can't put that out there in the open completely or else the film would never get made. It's enough of a miracle that this got made to begin with, but again, maybe those are for slightly different reasons. But yes, there is sort of a catharsis to it, and at times it feels like a primal scream of sorts, which might sound kind of strange because a lot of the movie is... There's a lot of quiet moments in this movie, but there are the scenes where she's lashing out at everybody, and it sort of feels as though... It's weird because at times it almost felt like Lonergan was writing himself into the character. I don't want to make an inference that's not there, but it's kind of... Because some of the things she says are so specific that I feel like maybe he's trying to get this idea out there, but he can only do it through the most destructive force possible, which is a well-off teenage girl. But again, I don't want to...
That gives us an interesting viewpoint on the way you look at the world.
Yes. But again, I don't want to pigeonhole it, because I think that when you look at the director's, or I'm sorry, extended cut, it becomes much more Brechtian in nature, with the opera score, of course. And I really, really love that decision because it gives everything a grander scope and the movie feels so much more tragic to me.
So you're telling me that the music wasn't the same in the theatrical cut?
No.
See, this is why I feel like I'm...
It's a really good score, though.
I feel like I'm really important to this discussion because my my complete and utter inability to comprehend what you're telling me about the theatrical cut lets me know how different they are.
But it is a good score. Nico Milhi, I think I said that right, wrote the score, and it's very effective.
Yeah, I really love that decision, and it sort of becomes an opera, when you could say. I mean, that's not a groundbreaking observation, but it becomes much more, to me, that supports my idea that Lonergan is sort of writing himself into this character at times, because as Jeannie Berlin yells at her, "This your life is not an opera," but that's exactly how he's playing it, in my estimation, that the theatrical cut loses.
And Danny, what about you? What do you think are the themes or narrative ideas behind this film?
Well, one of the things that I really liked with the extended cut is how kind of closely tied her character development is to those themes. Because like what Nick said, that line that Jeannie Berlin has, it's like Lisa's whole kind of character development is that she kind of thinks the world revolves around her, but it doesn't. And that's kind of what she realizes. And in the extended cut, there's just so much commitment to that idea. You're talking about the sound mix. And it's like, while she's having a conversation with this boy about why she doesn't love him, it's like obviously this very difficult conversation, but we can barely hear her. And so it's like, that's kind of, it's basically distilling her whole trajectory into that one formal move. And it happens so many times where she's walking in slow-mo across the street and buses pass in front of the screen and we lose sight of her and people walk across her and we can't see her face. And that ties into kind of that 9/11 treatment where it's like, should we dwell on it or should we recognize the fact that the world is going to still go on, and should we just go with that?
I have a similar read on it, I think, to most of you. I mean, we keep going back to that line, you know, your life is not an opera. And I think that's right, but the weird thing is that a lot of this movie comes down to communication. There are a lot of times when characters have to apologize for the way that they've worded something.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, and you know, most obviously, Margaret has to apologize for her use of the word strident. Which, for me, you know, just I think I kept thinking of the gum, so it didn't click with me immediately.
Really?
I don't hear the word strident a lot, except in terms of gum. So I was just like, that's. It took me a minute. I think I would have had the same reaction to her, like, oh my god, I can't believe I just used that word. I'm sorry. And I mean, her mother has to apologize as well. And you know, Ramon, his job is to create software to help two different kinds of softwares talk to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff in there that's about just the incompleteness of like modern human communication, even just on a verbal sense,
yeah.
And getting your ideas across, and the way that that keeps us from really interweaving with one another in a completely harmonious way. I mean, if you think about it, Lisa is very self-centered, yes, but the people who have to point out that to her are usually pointing it out to her because they're still very hung up on their own problems. I mean, you get this sense that Emily, the friend of Monica, the woman who was killed in the bus accident, when she's yelling at Lisa about the fact that, you know, her life isn't an opera, I think it's because she's a little upset that her own life isn't playing out in that way. She doesn't feel like there's enough emphasis on what she's going through. And there's the discussions in school when Lisa claims to kind of be able to read people who are having conflicts in other countries, and she like puts her motivations for them onto them. And there's this concept of never really being able to get what another person is going through because you can't divorce yourself from your own opinions and ideas about what either you would be going through in that same similar situation or the way that you see it affecting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the things that's so frighteningly deep and accurate about this film is that it does make you kind of reflect upon your own self. And every time that you've ever looked at something that's happened to you that you've taken some kind of issue with, and then you start to realize all the other people that were involved who either deserve just as much or possibly more attention because of that issue than you did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think it's telling that basically every scene except the final one is built on miscommunication, where a character will say something that either they meant it a certain way and it didn't come out that way, or the person heard it wrong, or, you know, you're distracting a bus driver, for example. But it's something that kind of, I think that was part of my problem with it the first time, is that it became very frustrating to watch when entire scenes are built upon. I mean, there's that scene where they're in the lawyer's office and it's the people over the speakerphone.
That was difficult to watch.
This is a personal thing. I hate speakerphones so much. So, and also I hate, like, I just hate phone conversations where you can't get a clear point across. So it just, God, that scene is so difficult to watch. And it all goes back to the idea that he's nailing down human behavior in a way that few movies do these days, to the point where you're watching it and you're just thinking, man, that scene played out right in my life. Like, you know, when Kieran Culkin came over my house and, right.
Whoa. A little personal.
Well, you know, after the credits, we can talk about that.
Jesus. No, we can't. I did want to talk, though. I mean, this movie, as much as we say that it's an expansive thing, and honestly, I think, I don't even know, if ever we were to have a spoiler warning for this film, I guess now would be the time, because we're going to talk about the quote-unquote resolution to the plot. You know, there is the bus accident, the thing that kind of is the driving force behind the narrative, which even still sounds reductive because there's so much other things going on. So consider this a spoiler warning, I guess. We're going to talk about the third act, even though we've already kind of touched on it. My confusion should give you an idea as to the depth of this film right now. So did you feel that the resolution to that and the way that it plays out, not only in terms of a plot device, but in Lisa's own kind of self-actualization, was that as strong as it could have been? Was that the best possible way to make it happen? Because if I'm being completely honest, which I should be, because that's the point of this show, there's the point when she's screaming into the speakerphone about why it's important to her that the bus driver gets fired, in addition to, you know, these awful people in Arizona getting money. And it's only at that point where she kind of comes clean and says that she believes it's her fault, which is something that I had literally been yearning for the entire film, because it was so aggravating to me that she was, like, putting her own self-recrimination on this one person. But, I mean, that's the only part to me that really felt kind of movie-like. Well, just that moment of catharsis and realization.
But I think that that moment is kind of an epiphany to her. It's kind of all spilling out at once, and maybe things that she's thought about, or, you know, she's considered but has not really given voice to, or, you know, admitted to herself. And, you know, in that moment, it's kind of, you know, and it's that's appropriately operatic, you know, for something like, you know, that it's almost like an aria. I mean, as she just kind of like works through all of these emotions and all of these ideas that, and things that, yeah, I think that she just didn't really want to admit to herself. But now that, you know, she's failed, it's just, yeah, she erupts.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any other direction she could go at that point, honestly, unless she became the most insufferable protagonist in any film last year, because I feel like that's what she would have become if there wasn't that scene. I do agree, maybe it feels a little too cinematic in a way.
Right, which is all that I'm saying. Like, I don't want to belittle the scene, or especially the acting in that scene and the writing, but it is just the one part that feels a little more movie than anything else.
Sure, but I also, if that is a problem, I feel as though maybe it's compensated for by the fact that there isn't really much of a plot resolution for the entire story, which I really like. You don't really know what happens to the bus driver, or what's going to happen with the money, or any of that. And because of that, I can forgive what in my view might be a slight misstep.
I think the way they end it with not being able to prosecute the bus driver is important for Lisa's character, because it just kind of, it does set off this epiphany where she realizes that the world doesn't really work how she would want it to. And that's when it kind of all comes crashing down on her and she erupts. But to me, like, that moment wasn't any more or less movie-like than, say, when Jeannie Berlin is yelling at her for using Strident. Or, like, there's a lot of other, like, kind of just yelling moments that I felt were on the same wavelength. I'm not sure that one felt more kind of unsatisfying than the other ones.
I guess. I mean, maybe it's just my own personal thing, because I know that I personally have gotten into arguments that have then turned into a completely different argument when I use the wrong word. You know, like I said, it's all about communication, and people will latch on to things like that, and this movie does a really excellent job of painting that. There was a point during this film when I said, I don't know who here is a fan of Aaron Sorkin, and I'm sorry that I'm about to insult you, or at least, you know, your love of Aaron Sorkin. I was like, this is Aaron Sorkin if Aaron Sorkin was a good writer. Like,
oh, that's a little unfair.
The emphasis on, you know, exactitude of speech. Like, his characters always say exactly what they mean to say.
Unless what exactly Aaron Sorkin means to say.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you had said that you felt, I think it was you, Nick, that you felt that he was putting words into Margaret's mouth, or, like, giving her the ideas that he wanted to put out there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in this movie, worked a lot better than it does in something like, Jesus, Studio 60 or The Newsroom, where a character literally just has a speech about it. Like, This is a movie that kind of revels in the uncertainty of the ideas, and the passionate, emotional, like, the person feels that it's correct, but they're not sure, and you can almost get their uncertainty through the mere volume that they're using to speak it, especially in those classroom scenes.
Mm-hmm. And yes. Yeah, more inexact than Sorkin likes to. Yeah, he'll bludgeon you.
Yeah, okay. Bludgeon is to put it lightly. Sorkin's bludgeoning is a normal person's pillow fight. But yeah, I mean, and it's one of these things. Like, I felt that, and I liked that. You know, like I said, that one scene just where she erupts was kind of the only vague misstep that I felt.
I guess John Gallagher Jr. gets both worlds then, because he's on The Newsroom and he plays Darren in Margaret.
He does, and this is kind of inconsequential to the discussion, but he makes that face. Apparently, as an actor, like, that face is the one thing that he's got, like, the confused, like, I'm trying to understand this face. If you've ever seen Yeah, if you've ever seen any episode of The Newsroom, there's at least six times per episode where he makes that face while talking to someone.
Mm-hmm.
That was really off-putting, again, because he's same guy, a little bit smaller and younger, but that face remains, and God, does it annoy the shit out of me.
He's good in this movie, though. He's great.
I mean, he's great
that,
in this movie.
I want to go back to that diner scene, if we may, for a little bit.
Yes.
I remember when I read that, I'm sure Jeremy knows what I'm talking about. It's structured very strangely in the screenplay, where you have basically two blocks of text of conversation, one on the left side and one on the right side. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I remember when I was reading the screenplay, I would kind of read one and then I'd read the other, and it doesn't, in that sense, it doesn't entirely flow. But then in the movie, it's this big mess of conversation, and the way he just sort of pushes in on them as they're talking, and it's clearly a very traumatic scene kind of for both of them. That was I can't believe that was not in the theatrical cut of the movie, because I think it's easily one of the best scenes in the entire film. And that further drove home the point of, that's actually the one scene, I think, where one of the few scenes where a character is saying exactly what they think, and another character is basically understanding it. It's just not going their way. And it's just, it's such a beautiful, tragic scene. And I love it so much. I needed to talk about it a little more.
And I feel like a lot of this movie for me is that way, which actually brings me to the sad point that we should probably wrap this conversation up. Sadly, I just need to show this movie to more people. So I assume that we all would say, you know, unqualifiably that people should go out and see this film.
Absolutely.
No, yeah. Voices of Dissent.
No, I would say see it. Just don't watch the trailer is what I'd say.
Oh, yeah. It's such a bad trailer.
I did not watch this trailer either. So
you have to watch it just like to just laugh.
Now that I've seen the movie, I can watch the trailer.
I think, if I remember right, the trailer starts with her calling Kieran Culkin to, like, take away her, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just like, okay, this isn't the movie. what's going on?
I was about to say, like, just you saying that, I can kind of see, like, that moment happening, and then, like, cut to, like, a title card, and then Vampire Weekend starts playing. Like, that's the type of wrong trailer that I'm picturing from you saying that.
Think it's like, it's kind of like Lisa has a problem.
They actually meet edit Lisa together to make it look like she's on her way to meet him when the bus accident happens. Which, it's... Oh, man, that is such a weird trailer. But,
yeah. I'm going to check that out. But, yeah, and we can all say that we should probably... That people watching this for the first time should probably see the extended cut first?
It's hard to say. I could, because I saw the theatrical cut so many times before I saw the extended cut, and I'm glad I had that experience. But there's not a right answer here. You know, I guess I'm going to be real wishy-washy and just not state a preference for what you should watch first. If you want to watch a kind of longer, more expansive movie, then that definitely do the 3-hour. But the theatrical cut has its strengths as well. It has a different flow. So yeah, I don't know. Just throw a dart.
I feel like I sort of appreciate the extended cut more after seeing the theatrical cut a couple of times, because I don't know, the additions just felt so much stronger to me when they're finally reinserted, which maybe is a little, maybe I'm being a little too lenient toward the movie then. It's like, well, if I watch this inferior version first, it'll look even better.
I was about to say, it's like, oh, this car is so much better than the car I just drove that didn't have any brakes.
Exactly. But yeah, most, I guess, you know, 3 out of 4 of us saw the theatrical cut first and we made it out okay. So yeah, throw a dart, I would say.
And some of you also read the script, which I have not done, though I'm very interested to do now, so I'll have to go find that.
How many pages is it? Do you remember?
186, I think.
Oh,
yep.
Wow.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So, Margaret, definitely see it. See whichever version the dart hits. Or I guess see which version the dart doesn't hit, since that DVD is going to have a hole in it. So moving on from there, let's take a look at what's coming out this week, so we can give you at home a... vaguely educated guess at what are your best bets for this week.
There are no best bets for next week.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is gonna be a quick one. Looking at new DVD and Blu-ray releases, from DVDsReleaseDates.com. It's not really that great. Hatfields and McCoys from the History Channel is coming out. I did not see that. Did anyone actually watch any of that?
No.
Damn. I would say, you know, it's an interesting story on a purely historical level, and I have no idea the quality of the show, but I would probably rather see that than anything else, because everything else includes LOL, which I believe is starring Miley Cyrus, and ATM, which is an interesting film up until the point that it tried to make a twist at the end, and then it was awful. Did anyone else see ATM?
No. Skip that one.
Yeah, I would say skip it. Because really, like, whatever interesting, like, goodwill it had just from its premise, like, died by the end of it. Coming to theaters, August 3rd, we have Total Recall, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days. And then, we have a couple of limited releases coming out. Celeste and Jesse Forever, 360, which is the new film by Fernando Morales from City of God, Constant Gardner.
Oh, yes, he made a good movie once. That's right.
So you're not a fan of Constant Gardner?
Oh, he did make that. It's okay. It's a total... It's so like the kind of independent movie that would play at your multiplex, if you will.
Yeah, I guess.
Does that make sense? It's just kind of... You watch it and... You what?
Oh, no, I love the Constant Gardner.
Yeah, no, I loved the Constant Gardner, too.
Get out of here, Nick.
No, I feel bad.
Nick. Hey, we're here to express opinions, even the wrong ones, Nick.
All right.
I'm one of like two people I know who actually liked Blindness, though. But I read the book first, so maybe I'm just weird. But yeah, other than that, it's something called Baby Makers, which I've never heard of. Not really much coming out there. Nick, you're usually our go-to man for things coming out on Criterion. Do you have anything to add in that realm?
They're releasing Le Havre from Aki Kaurismäki. Did anybody see that movie?
Yeah. I'm not.
Did not, no.
Oh, it's actually on Hulu Plus, so if you have that service, you can watch it right now. It's been on there for a while. I watched it back in January, actually, and that's a very good film. I believe the Blu-ray is supposed to be, from what I've heard, it's quite excellent. Not a surprise from Criterion, but some people are saying it's one of their best transfers yet. That's exciting, because that's a beautiful movie.
Any director's cut information?
No, I don't believe so. You know Criterion would release it. And also, a film that is... in that set, but it's not being released by them, is Grand Illusion, which is coming out on Blu-ray. What else can you say about that?
Kind of a good movie.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's okay. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Just too bad they're not, it's Lionsgate putting it out, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it blows.
So does anyone actually have an opinion on Total Recall? Is this the type of thing that anyone's going to go out and see and maybe have dumb fun with, or are we all thinking it's going to be terrible?
I'm going to avoid it. I have no use for this remake. Yeah. PG-13.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a depressing look at the week ahead. But hey, you got Margaret to look forward to. So
you could always watch that.
Exactly. And again, you got options even in the idea of watching Margaret. So let us now give a little brief look at what we've been watching outside of theatrical and new DVD releases and talk about our random recommendations for this week. Nick, why don't you start us off?
I've watched so much this week, so much good stuff. I think in terms of, I'm going to cheat a little here, because normally we just pick one film, but I'm going to select three, actually. But there is a reason. We're all fans of The 400 Blows, right?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Come on.
Absolutely.
I'd seen that movie years and years ago, but for some reason had never caught up with the Antoine Doinel sequels. It was a big blind spot for me, so I watched... I'd already seen Antoine and Colette, which is the follow-up, which is like 30 minutes long, but then I watched Stolen Kisses, Bed and Board, and Love on the Run, and they're pretty freaking great, I gotta say. A lot of fun, very heartfelt. Yeah, I mean, Truffaut, he's pretty good, if you guys have heard. Yeah, they're great. Please watch them.
Only because you asked so nicely. That was
yeah. No, but really what I'm saying is that I think there are some people who might have the perception that, well, they're the follow-ups and they're not as discussed as 400 Blows, so perhaps they're lesser. But I would not say that. I think they're really beautiful, fantastic movies.
And Danny, what about yourself?
I watched Tom Tykwer's Heaven on Netflix Instant. He is recently of the Cloud Atlas director's trailer fame. so I went and watched this, and I really liked it. It's the kind of thing where the second half kind of does a complete U-turn from the first half. So I won't really go into it for the sake of spoilers, but either you will buy the kind of like weird symbolism of the second half or you won't. And I definitely did. So there's that.
Interesting. I do like him as a director, so I may have to check that out.
Yeah, and it was actually written by Krzysztof Kieslowski. So that makes it even more interesting.
That changes the game.
Yeah.
Jeremy, what about yourself?
I'm going to recommend a movie I've kind of been obsessed with since I revisited it like a month ago. And that's George Axelrod's Lord Love a Duck, which is a bizarre coming-of-age comedy from 1966 with Roddy McDowall and Tuesday Weld. And it's wacky. I mean, it's kind of... If David Lynch made a teen comedy...
Have you not seen Fire Walk With Me?
Yes. Oh, well, yeah, there is that. I mean, it's and I'm not even saying that it's truly Lynchian, but there are like those kind of like just out there moments where you're just like, who the hell thought to make this movie? But it's, it's a singular film. And Axelrod, he was a writer. He wrote like The 7 Year Itch and some other stuff that was a little more conventional. This is not conventional in the least.
I've not heard of that film, but now it's kind of on the top of my list. Personally, I'm going to recommend a film that came to my mind because of the aforementioned Cloud Atlas trailer. But first, I'd like to say, did everyone here like the Cloud Atlas trailer?
I did.
Nick's now afraid to voice the dissenting opinion.
No, I didn't really feel anything from it. It clearly was going for that emotional grandeur in a 6-minute span, which even for a trailer, it's still... I got to see it in full, because even in a 6-minute form, it's clearly condensed into a unsuitable manner. I mean, you can still like the trailer, of course, plenty of people do, but... I was left a little cold by it, to be honest. It looked cool. Eh?
Danny, did you have an opinion? Do you want to jump into the frame?
I didn't watch it because I'm reading the book, so I'll watch it right after I finish the book, which will be probably a while because it's kind of long and a weird read.
Well, I saw that trailer after a full day of seeing people tweet about how awesome it was, and I was extremely disappointed, to say the least. I think that a lot of that could have to do with the fact that, you know... It seems like it's a very ambitious, wide-ranging novel made into a movie, made into a 6-minute trailer. And part of it could also just be because it kind of looks awful. But that's just one man's opinion. But I did... I'm trying for the Royal Tenenbaum, you know, diversion. I did not like that trailer at all. I still see the film. It looks like it could be interesting. Whether it's an interesting triumph or fiasco is to be seen. But it did leave me in the mood to watch The Fountain by Darren Aronofsky. And this is another one. Never quite sure how people are going to react, but I really love that film. Anyone want to tell me that I'm an idiot?
Nick? Nope. I...
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting movie.
Nick, you're the voice of dissent on this podcast. You have to not be afraid to say what you mean.
It's interesting.
Okay, excellent. Well, yes, it is an interesting thing. I don't know, I was looking for a little bit of a, you know, a recommendation or like something else. But anyway, yeah, no, The Fountain. Darren Aronofsky, before he went into this kind of, you know, gritty realist thing that he's doing now, as much as Black Swan could be called to be gritty and realist, you know, it's the last really audacious movie that he made on a stylistic level close to Requiem for a Dream. And I love it. It's really good. I think the emotions in it are really powerful. And I don't know. I think in the right mood, it could be a guy cry film. So I would say check it out. Bring some friends along. But yeah, that's my recommendation. And that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you for joining us again. I'm going to turn it over to everyone so they can tell you where to find them on the internet in the interim between now and next week when we'll come back to talk about something. I don't know what we're going to talk about, and I apologize in advance if it's Total Recall.
How do you make a discussion out of that movie?
I don't know. I mean, we could talk about remakes.
Well, we could talk about what is real or what is recall.
That's actually... That would be an interesting... No. All right, so Jeremy, as the guest, why don't you go first and tell us where we can find you online?
You can find me at Ain't It Cool News, where I write as Mr. Beaks, and on Twitter, it's Mr. Beaks, all one word, M-R-B-E-A-K-S. Yeah, that's where I am.
Excellent. Danny?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter /TheKingBulletin.
Nick?
FilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
All right. And of course, you can find me at FilmStage.com, also DearFilm.net, my personal blog, and on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, Brian with nine. So once again, thank you very much. Subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, and we look forward to speaking at you next week. I was wondering if anyone had an idea or wanted to say.
Oh, sorry.
I was about to say, was, man, did idea. I just get a standing ovation? I know what the after credits blooper is going to be. All right. There goes my train of thought. Derailed like Super 8.